Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, today joined by Chris Hutton. Let's get into the news of today, and we have to talk, of course, about this story, which is that the government is not doubling down on BEE, but tripling down on BEE. Yeah, the Minister of Labour has published a set of new regulations which will be applied to 18 defined economic sectors across the economy, which will essentially set racial quotas for various sections of the economy. The five-year employment equity targets are assigned to these 18 economic sectors, and they set the percentages of the four upper occupational levels: top management, senior management, professionally qualified or middle management, and skilled technical or junior management, which must be occupied by designated groups, which are described here as namely historically disadvantaged groups of people based on race, gender, and disability. This has been attacked by us at the Institute of Race Relations, but also by Sakhalika, who put out an absolutely blistering press release on this. They said the South African government has published its new racial hiring quotas. The regulations herald perhaps the most sweeping racialization of the South African labor market, seeking to impose racial hiring quotas on local and international companies alike and threatening to destroy hundreds of billions of rands in economic value if diligently enforced. Failure to comply with these can result in a 10% fine of turnover of a company. Companies under 50 employees are exempt, which I suppose is a small mercy, but not a particularly significant one. The Sakhalika defines the 18 sectors of the economy as sort of not that well defined, and points out that in certain categories, for example, in financial insurance and businesses, top management is allowed to be 37% white male. A skilled technical category will only allow to be made up of 4% white males. There's sort of, you can go sector by sector to every part of the economy here. Chris, this, considering, okay, let's talk about BEE as a policy, right? Has been in place since, what, the early 2000s. And it has been, in many ways, one of the most aggressively enforced of all government policies, particularly within government itself, but they've also attempted to do it to some degree in the private sector as well. And I think the evidence is clear that it has categorically failed to do anything other than create an enriched class of elite, politically connected people at the top, while the vast majority of South Africans languish in poverty and unemployment. What are your thoughts on this story, Chris?
So I think a few things. I mean, we've, in the last while, about foreign policy and geopolitical matters, been talking about South Africa possibly being... having US sanctions imposed either on sort of leaders in the ANC or maybe on the country as a whole. When you talk about something like BEE and this level of attempt at minute economic control of bureaucrats and politicians who think they can decide what subsectors should look like, what businesses should look like, etc., that's a form of self-imposed economic sanction. You dissuade companies from, number one, employing more people to get above the 50 employee mark, so that affects employment in and of itself, but also just how companies, what decisions they, what basis they use to make hiring decisions. So if you talk about wanting a growing economy, an inclusive economy, that favorite word of people such as President Ramaphosa and others, can we just get a growing economy in the first place? A fellow at the IRR, Gabriel Krauser, last year, he wrote a piece for News 24 where he highlighted that black unemployment swelled from 23% in 2007 to 37.6% at the latest count in 2024. So if you talk about just measuring policies and legislation on the basis of their supposed intentions and outcomes, BEE has failed in South Africa's case. This morning, in our latest risk alert at the CRA, we did detail some of the implications here. And if you just think through where this sort of thing takes you, so it's not just that, for example, white males are at risk of being excluded. It's this sort of minute societal and economic control and business control affects everyone. So in our assessment, in our analysis, all races and genders are exposed to the risk of being excluded, as is made clear by the regulation, which states that all employers with more than 50 employees, quote, must avoid perpetuating the overrepresentation of any group, if their representation exceeds the applicable economically active population in a particular occupational level, end quote. So that means, if you take it to its logical conclusion, if a large company has a C-suite in which 60% are Black women, then it must aim to reduce the quote-unquote overrepresentation of Black women by refusing to hire Black women in that management category. The same holds for all race, gender pairs. You talk about having the effect of stifling investment, upskilling people, trying to grow businesses, trying to get businesses to take on the risk of employing more people. This is in a case study of what policies should not be applied that prevent economic growth. This is, I mean, not economics 101. This is non-economics, non-growth 101.
Right. The consequences of this will be more waste, more racialization, and ultimately more poverty. It's not going to help the people that it supposedly is supposed to be helping. It's going to hurt minority South Africans, particularly white South Africans, in seeking their place in the economic system. And it's going to further create dysfunction in our society. It is completely the wrong way to go, and it should be opposed by all South Africans of all races and all economic strata, because it will make life difficult for everyone who is not already a politically connected cadre.
Nick, if I may.
All right, go ahead. Yeah,
just on the waste and sort of corruption opportunities that this sort of thing opens up again. Because, for example, if a company now runs foul of these new regulations, upon first failure to comply with the regulations, the maximum fine is 1.5 million rand, or 2% of annual turnover, or this climbs to a maximum of 2.7 million rand, or 10% of annual turnover on the fourth failure to comply. And the Minister of Labour last year promised to hire 20,000 labour inspectors who are empowered by the new regulations to issue compliance orders. So just on the fines and those inspectors, I mean, this increases the incentive so much for businesses to use what resources they do have to make sure that they're not fined, and also to ensure that they get the quote-unquote compliance certificates or whatever. I mean, if you take this to the level of ridiculousness, is this going to be sort of at the entrance to your business, which says, yes, this company has been inspected on this date, there are zero incidents of breaking this regulation since X date, and there are no fines imposed? Yeah, just to reinforce your point on the corruption and waste, that this sort of thing is going to encourage. It's not going to be an accident. It's going to be a feature.
Yeah, on that point, and the minister is able to grant particular exemptions to particular businesses. Well, how do you think that's going to be used? It's going to be used to extract concessions, to extract bribes, to extract all sorts of special favors from businesses, used to threaten them when they don't comply with government's will. He'll say, well, we'll give you exempt status if you kowtow to us. But if you displease us, then we'll make sure that you get inspected toot sweet. Terrible piece of legislation, terrible piece of regulation. And yeah, we'll be doing everything we can, I think, to push back on it, as will other organizations like Sakalika, which is already threatening to take this issue to court. Okay. Let's go and talk a little bit about the politics. There's been a lot of polling out recently from us at the IRR. They're from the Brenthurst Foundation, also from the Social Research Foundation. And it's found pretty much that the ANC is not in a great place right now, particularly in the middle of the VAT fight, which was when our poll was done. For the first time ever in a national poll, DA overtook the ANC. Apparently, there are members now within the ANC who are pushing on the government, or at least the ruling party from inside, that they should not kick the DA and Freedom Front Plus out of the GNU. Paul Mashatile and large chunks of the ANC have basically been calling for the DA and the Freedom Front Plus to be kicked out of the government of national unity. But this is now receiving pushback with people inside the ANC highlighting the fact that many of the polls recently have shown that South Africans, by and large, including ANC and DA supporters, by and large, think that the GNU is generally a good idea and is performing better than the previous ANC government. These anonymous insiders speaking to the media say that for the ANC to eject the DA and Freedom Front Plus from the government of national unity now would be catastrophic for their relations with many of their own voters. And I think the polling definitely seems to hold that up. At the same time, IOL, which has long been the news site you know, affiliated with Jacob Zuma and his faction in South African politics, has released audio of Jacob Zuma speaking where he says that he has turned down advances from the Government of National Unity by the ANC, seemingly indicating that the ANC is preciously short on potential partners. Now, the EFF has also, I think, publicly said similar things, that they are not interested in forming a government with the ANC right now, but they've also said they were, if the DA and the Freedom Front Plus weren't in there. So, you know, all of this, I think, is subject to change, but the general sort of rule seems to be that kind of everyone right now is starting to push back on the ANC, and they are finding themselves with increasingly few avenues to get out of this mess. I don't know, Chris, do you agree with that analysis?
I think, yeah, there's so much going on at the moment. I do take the quote-unquote leaked audio with more than a pinch of salt from former President Zuma. For one thing, he's speaking English, and from what I've heard and been told, at most, if not all, of those high-level MK meetings, he will speak in isiZulu, given that is, of course, his background, and just, you know, I guess that's how he wants to run those sorts of meetings. So just on the veracity thereof, I do question, but it's interesting that it's being floated right now, that sort of narrative, by MK and MK-linked or MK-affiliated outlets and sort of sources, as it were, because it could be a way for MK to still try and sell itself to its voters that it is the alternative to the ANC. So now it's trying to show that they won't compromise. And if they do on anything, they're going to extract very harsh concessions. So it could just be that sort of optics narrative game. Regarding the reporting on the Institute's polling and some of the influence it's having within the ANC, I think there's quite a bit of credence to that, because I think we still see, I know it feels like lifetimes ago, given everything that's happened over the last year, since May of last year when we had our last elections, but the ANC, for many in the leadership and in the party, I think they're still trying in some large and some small ways to figure out, what should the party be doing? Why did it only get 40%? Why did it suffer a 17 percentage point drop from 2019? Why is it down from almost two-thirds majority in about 2004? What are the answers? And part of that would be they're looking at different sources. They're trying to find ways of figuring out, how does the ANC still retain power? And perhaps one way to do so is to remain in the current constellation of the GNU, deal with the headaches that the DA presents them, but figure out, well, they're still the biggest party in government and they should retain this control where possible. So a lot of it will also just come down to survivalist instincts. How do you retain access to state resources, et cetera? That the polling indicates there's more support still for the GNU than against it, even though it is somewhat abating and declining from where it was last year, that level of support among South Africans. It's still the most sort of popular constellation or coalition government that is on offer at this point in time. So maybe just better to wait it out. I don't know if there's any longer term strategy at play for the ANC here.
All right, let's move on to our last story. Gwede Mantashe, the Minerals and Petroleum Minister, has laid out an empowerment blueprint for the oil and gas exploration sector. There is the potential that South Africa has fairly significant reserves of oil and gas in some parts of the country, and also potentially off our coast, particularly up by our border with Namibia. But there have been hesitations by many large companies to actually explore these for a variety of reasons. And it looks like Gwede Mantashe is continuing to triple down on BEE, as are his compatriots in the Labor Department. According to this new blueprint, empowerment requirements will play a critical role in the adjudication of exploration licenses. Companies will have to provide extensive details on how they will empower communities they do business in, how they plan to empower Black people and Black-owned businesses. This is all part of what is described as a local content plan, and there will have to be training, skills transfer schemes for Black South Africans. The regulations open for public comment also must include employment equity statistics, the holders' plan to achieve Black people's participation, including women in all levels of management, various requirements for how they must contribute to the local community, housing, living conditions, all these sort of things, as well as ownership statistics. So once again, we're seeing a whole bunch of things here, which are going to make particularly, I think, foreign businesses who have many other options go, well, why don't we just invest in Australia? Why don't we just invest in, you know, literally anywhere else? And we'll continue, I think, with this kind of regulation to see our mining and mineral sector stagnate and decline as it has been for the previous couple of years, which of course means more layoffs and less tax revenue. What's your take on this, Chris?
Yeah, just to link it to our first story. I mean, if you talk about the current geopolitical moment and the foreign policy challenges that the Trump administration is now presenting to South Africa, this story and the first story, it provides yet more ammunition for the administration and those linked to the administration to say, see, South Africa is doing these things in terms of its policy and legislation. And also, on top of that, if you talk about South Africa trying to use what it has in its favor, lots of mineral resources, geostrategically very well placed, a young growing population, if you talk about getting investment and job creation from as many sources as possible, be it the US, China, elsewhere, this sort of thing just raises more barriers to that investment. Why would you want to go through this sort of thing? This isn't to say that there won't be those players who see an opportunity again for corruption, for theft, because they'll lay out whatever they need to secure access to make sure that their local content plan is better than whoever else's, even if it isn't on its own merits. It's just about getting it in front of the right people and making sure that you sweeten that deal as much as possible. So it's going to encourage that sort of rent-seeking, cronyist behavior. I don't think there's any reason to expect otherwise. And it really does hold back South Africa's growth potential from a cheaply available and cheaply affordable energy source point of view, which we do have, again, in our favor, which would make us quite a bit more secure in the current context of things being upended quite a bit globally.
Indeed it would. All right, that's all the time we have for today. Apologies if I was a bit low energy. I have a head-splitting headache, but I got through this, as did all of us today. I hope you found this show interesting, and we will see you all tomorrow on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a great day. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR, or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.